Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Welcome. Before I go on any further, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from, and also too. I'd also like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival, and a big shout out to everybody from around the continent that is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service NIRS. And if you're tuning in via our app, 98.9 FM, for the best country. And don't forget, you can stream us via Spotify and Apple Podcast. And this program is uploaded to our website, 98.9fm.com.au, where you can check out previous Let's Talk podcast programs as well. And as always, it is great to have your company. So following on from my conversations with Karina and also Brother Kevin about looking at our reaction to the Incarceration Nation film. My next guest has seen the film, rewatched it last night for our conversation. And it's not a critique, we're just going to look at sort of, you know, some aspects of the film and give our thoughts. It's been a very busy sort of presence online in regards to the film as well. So it's really good to have this conversation. And my guest on the program was a former host. Hopefully, you know, that we can get him back in and doing the thing again. But good morning, Chel sis. How you going? That's good. And just before we go any further, your mob in your country, please.
Hey, so my name's Chelsea Wattigo. I'm Manajali and South Sea through the Wattigo and Williams family, born and raised on Yuggera country. Yeah, and thanks for having me. I missed this place.
Yeah, no, it's been ages, you know, since last time you were in as well. And I guess there's been a lot happening, you know, that you've been up to as well, that I guess to keep yourself occupied from having Friday
things,
mornings.
Mate. Just a few things.
That's good, that's good. Also, you know, as I just sort of mentioned, online's been heating up in relation to the recent film Incarceration Nation, which was aired on NITV just the previous Sunday as well. And the very heavy film, you know, the voices of family members who have lost loved ones, you know, lawyers who have sort of represented family and their the loved ones, and also you know, mob who have written, you know, stories after stories about loved ones, or even just sort of looking at how, you know, different structures impact on our mob as well. Sis, your thoughts on the film, please.
Yeah, I guess before talking about the film, I want to acknowledge the families of those who shared their story about the brutalisation of their loved ones in custody. You know, I can't imagine what it is to have to relive, retell these stories to a public that is not always ready to listen or empathise with those stories. And also I want to acknowledge the families of those who didn't get to tell their story either, because we know there's a violence in being silenced as well. So I just want to, I guess, in having this conversation is remember that we're talking about the brutality that blackfellas continue to experience in this place, and it's important that as we have this conversation that we don't revisit that brutality upon the families who have laid bare their trauma in the hope that somehow this place will recognise our humanity. And so, and you know, all of the families and loved ones who so generously shared their story, you know, that's a gift that they've given. And we know that they share that pain, not necessarily for their own healing, but so that other people do not have to go through what they've gone through. You know, there's a generosity when our families put themselves before the public each and every time to tell those stories. And, you know, and they did their families proud. You know, you can't talk about The brutality of the colony without hearing and foregrounding the accounts of blackfellas first and foremost. And I think that, you know, that's so very important in all of this. So I'm conscious that I think there's some questions that this documentary raises about our strategy for inspiring action, for effecting change. And there's some questions about, you know, trauma discourse, about how effective it is when we lay bare our wounds, what it does for us as well in that process. For those who haven't watched, it is a really heavy film, and it covers a lot of territory. I think that, you know, the producers had a very ambitious task with what they were doing. The tragedy of this is that, you know, they're spoilt for choice when it comes to telling the story of the brutality of this place. There are so many stories, so many accounts, and what the documentary shows is the, even with such a small number of stories, the overwhelming evidence of how violent the legal system is for Indigenous peoples. And so they also place it in its historical context. I have some issues around how the historical context is situated with this. But, you know, and you hear from different voices. You hear from lawyers, from academics, economists, abolitionists, family members. So they've tried to get, I guess, a broad cross-section of different voices to shed light on the understanding of this issue. I think it's an hour and a half. I got to see it in preview and share my feedback at the time with the production team and others that were in that preview screening. When it went to air, I couldn't watch it. I felt uncomfortable with it, and uncomfortable perhaps with my complicity in it as someone who featured in it. But I watched it again last night in order to have this conversation and to think about the experiences of families who were watching that, and what they need from this documentary and what they need from us as a result of what they shared in that documentary. Because all of the political intellectual questions aside, the reality is we've got families who've laid bare their wounds. Now, what is our obligation to them to care for them and to make sure that that they didn't that wasn't a waste of their time? So it's with that I kind of come to this conversation.
Yeah, definitely, sis. For myself, I watched it. I started watching it Sunday night. Then I switched it off, watched the live online with Keenan and Carly and Dean and Josh and Karina. And then I went back and watched it the next day as well. As I mentioned to you off air, it was, you know, this film and another film that was made by a blackfella as well, and centering, you know, our stories, was after the apology, very, very heavy, much needed, you know, conversation around the issue of the high representation of young Indigenous kids in out-of-home care, and sort of talking about that pipeline from you know, out-of-home care to prison as well. You know, that'd be the two recent films where sort of I had to stop and, you know what I mean, sort of it sort of hit you different. So I could sort of understand where you were, you know, Sunday night, in terms of like, you know, I cannot watch it because of, you know, one, you've already watched it, but then also thinking about, you know, everything else that, you know, I went into it as well. And you made some good points in terms of historically as well, looking at incarceration as well. Outside of work, you know, I'm very fortunate to sort of, you know, do my own podcast, and one part that of the podcast that one episode that I really like and that I found I'm not amazing, but I just didn't know this aspect of our history is, you know, we've always been an incarcerated people when it comes to one, Australia being here, but then two, you know, the British sort of occupying our country as well. I thought that was a you know, a good aspect in terms of, in the film where they looked at sort of, you know, the bloodshed that was spilt historically, you know, and I think Josh Cremer, you know, put some numbers and some stats out in terms of how many blackfellas, you know, died here in Queensland alone in frontier conflict as well. I'd love to sort of, yeah, get your thoughts because, you know, they talked about policies, you know, they talked about early sort of incarceration and sort of, you know, violence on the frontier as well. So I'd love to get your thoughts around sort of that historical aspect.
Yeah, well, I thought that giving, you know, placing this in its historical context was so important. And what was interesting, so they looked at, and I think this is the challenge of looking at incarceration across the nation, is you have different states with different policies enacted in different kinds of ways, but certainly shared policy eras. You know, the protection era is one that's shared but enacted differently across different states. But in the documentary, they look at the Queensland Protection Act. What's interesting, I think, in how it's narrated in terms of linking historical context to the contemporary context of incarceration is it tells a story of the violence of the Protection Act on the one hand, but then talks about, you know, blackfellas coming into the cities in the 70s and then becoming incarcerated because of intergenerational trauma and access to employment and education, which at one level, yes, but the Protection Act saw blackfellas cast as inmates. We were all made wards of the state. We were incarcerated since 1897 and was sanctioned by the state to incarcerate us based on Aboriginality alone. So this this place has always, when they couldn't erase us, you know, physically, and removed us from our land, and onto missions and reserves, which we see references to us as inmates. So I think that point was missed in the documentary, that was incarceration under the Protection Act. It wasn't a matter of us coming off missions and reserves and then stepping to cities and suddenly becoming incarcerated. This was a seamless continuation of the state incarcerating black people and finding legal means by which to brutalise us. And so it just keeps manifesting itself in different kinds of ways. But it's the same thing. It's the same goal. And so I think, you know, the removal of Aboriginal children from our families, the continuation of that, it is seamless, and with all the inquiries and the reports and investigations, what we see is they get better at doing it. Like, Aboriginal women are the fastest growing prison population. Like, we've just had the 30th year anniversary of the Royal Commission to Aboriginal Deaths in Custody with all these recommendations, and what does the Queensland government do this year? Introduces laws that are visited upon our young people to make sure that they are further incarcerated. When we know the Royal Commission to Aboriginal Deaths in Custody recommended, incarceration as last resort, of finding ways to reduce the ways in which Indigenous people get into custody. Mm-hmm. Yet at the same time, we have a Labor government increasing laws, criminalising, increasing focus on carceral solutions that they know will be targeted at us first. So this place is intent on incarcerating us. It's never relinquished that task. And that's, I think, the fundamental flaw of the documentary is it's based on an assumption that the state doesn't know what it's doing. The incarceration of blackfellas has always been in their economic interests, in their political interests. It's not that they haven't realised that maybe they could spend the money elsewhere. I mean, that projected $1.9 billion of, you know, the cost of incarcerating Indigenous peoples, that money goes somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's not wasted.
Mm-hmm.
Brutalising black people is profitable in this place. And that's what's missed here. It's always been profitable. I mean, stolen wages. That's why we were incarcerated. That's why they kept our wages. You know, so it's... So there was... I just think there was some missed opportunities there to show the seamlessness of this, of the state-sanctioned violence. And in that, you can still tell a story about black resistance, about black power. You know, the story of Aunty Tina Day's family and the way in which they changed the law so that to decriminalise public drunkenness, which will save the lives of so many other people, not just blackfellas, will save the lives of so many other people.
And I think, didn't they like highlight the fact that, like, we all know that, you know, it's racist, you know, when our mob come in contact with the police or prison custody, and they sadly pass away. But I think around that time as well, there's a discussion around how I think they, it was in regards to, it was racist and discriminatory in terms of, you know, how the courts looking at it as well. I think I remember we had a chat to April last year in regards to that as well. But just really quickly, if you are tuning into the program, my guest on the program on Let's Talk is Chelsea Wattigo. We're having a yarn about the film Incarceration Nation, which looks at the overrepresentation of our mob in prisons, and also when our mob come in contact with these institutions, and the high number of our mob dying in custody. I must note as well, as Chelsea mentioned, this year was the 25th anniversary of the Royal Commission. 30th anniversary of the Royal Commission to Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, when the report was handed down. And since March, I believe it was, 10 Aboriginal people have died in prison custody since then as well. You know, so this sort of... Kevin, you know, quoted you, and I showed you the quote earlier, you know, this whole thing of F Hope,
yep.
You know, and you mentioned sort of the Labor Party, you know, funneling hundreds of millions of dollars into, you know, this new Youth Bail Law Act. They have it here and also in the NT, and the film highlights sort of this paperless arrest that happens in the NT as well, and, you know, to make up, which really, you know, shows the number of our mob incarcerated as well. You know, let's talk about this thing of sort of, you know, the hope or something that we, you know, may have for, whether it's, you know, thinking that politicians may sort of change these things as well. You know, countless times, you know, we see politicians always promising, you know, different things to our mob, whether it's, you know, I think on the cards in most states, it was, you know, negotiations for treaties, you know, and that sort of have always been on sort of the lips of blackfellas, especially since the 80s, you know, since bicentennial protests and stuff as well. You know, let's talk about this hope that, you know, our mob do have for things that, you know, may change, but in reality, you know, nothing necessarily changes for us.
Well, so this is my issue with sometimes when we lay bare our wounds, it's based on an assumption that we can appeal to the humanity of our perpetrator, that if they saw how violent they would be less violent. That logic doesn't work. It really doesn't. What it does sometimes, it inspires action amongst mob. It fires mob up. And so we have to know that's important. When our mob get a sense of that, so it does serve a function. But we've got to know for who and for what. Showing the perpetrator how violent they are doesn't inspire them to change. For me, the only way we can get change is if we compel change. And that means strategising all kinds of ways, whether it's on the streets, whether it's in courtrooms. I mean, it struck me that we had Josh Creamer on that documentary and we didn't hear the story of Palm Island mob taking the Queensland government on race discrimination. That's such a powerful story, that blackfellas aren't passively, suffering this abuse and violence. We're fighting back, and we're fighting back in really, really inspiring ways. We don't need white people to come and save us from their own violence. It's about how do we strategize and organize intellectually, politically, legally, mm-hmm. to get what's ours, mm-hmm. to get justice for our people. Mm-hmm. And we had the actors there. We had April. I mean, Ani Latona. We didn't hear about the United Nations case. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw the wounds, but we didn't see the warriorship that we know is there, that could have inspired an audience to go, wow, maybe we can learn something about resistance, resilience and activism from the black people who've been brutalised. Mm. Maybe they're not nameless, voiceless subjects being bashed in prison cells. Mm. And so that's what, for me, was missing, was that the story of what Ani Tenure Day's family did and what they achieved, because changing that law was a recommendation from the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, and had it been implemented, their mum would still be alive. Mm-hmm. But they still got the law changed as a result. So I just think in the course of doing this work, when we look at the violence of racism and colonial violence, we have to think about the assumptions that we're trading off when we're telling these stories and the ethics around how we tell these stories. I wonder with you, with doing Frontier Wars, you've got to deal with the task that Fiona Foley speaks of, where how do you represent violence without reproducing it?
Originally what I want to do with the podcast is I didn't want to talk about massacres, because, we've grown up in our communities knowing where these sites are,
mm-mm.
In our towns and on our country. So, for the most part of the podcast, I try and steer clear of that mm-hmm. as a conscious sort of thing in my own head, and when I talk
Who's your podcast for?
For blackfellas. Foremost, and the white fellas are picking up, good on them,
mm-mm.
Even though they're helping the streams and whatever, but good on them.
They can listen.
Yep. Pay some cash, whatever. It was a conscious decision from the beginning, and even when I talk to black fellas, I want to know more about other than just sort of the brutalization of our mob. I want to know about the resistance and the resilience as well.
Mm-mm.
It's amazing, some of the conversations I have. The first episode, I yarn with brother boy Callum about his book, and we get to the end, and I go, what about the we sort of have a moment where we pause and like we remember, we know, because his book's about the first 40 years of the colonial apocalypse, and mm-hmm. after that we know, the eventual sort of thing that happens. Mob get removed, get placed on sort of missions in different parts, and these acts and policies become more and more strict. It's inevitable, when we're talking about history. So no, I'm very, very conscious about that, and I try my best to sort of stay away from that. Even though there's academics out there whose sort of work is just wholly and solely on that, I've chatted to them about these things, mm. I try and highlight, the tactics and sort of the resilience and sort of, what we were known for, other than sort of, what we're told as only happened.
Yeah, and because the consequence of just showing violence is what we see then that follows is a discourse of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's explicit in the documentary. So in the promo, and there's a graphic in it as well, where it says the two drivers of Indigenous incarceration are trauma and disadvantage. Mm-hmm. That doesn't relate to Money Tenure Day's story.
Well, none of the blackfellas.
No, that's not the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in itself serves a kind of political function in the colony, that somehow the wounds upon our body are of our own making, and there's a violence in that claim. There's another graphic where it says the underlying causes, so it's poverty and disadvantage are the causes of incarceration, the underlying causes are trauma. No, this is racial violence. We have to name it for what it is. And we do it. And the thing is April talks about how in her mother's coronial inquiry, this was the first time that systemic racism could be investigated, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was a big thing. And you think about all the deaths of blackfellas in custody. This was the first time, that would be included in the investigation. It shows how violent this place is and how much it lies in, protecting itself. But even when they found the statistical analysis and they had an exact identical example of a non-Indigenous woman who was driven safely home, the coroner refused to see racism, refused to name it. And that to see that reproduced then in this documentary, to not say, no, the cause of Indigenous incarceration, the root cause is racial violence. Mm. And naming it for what it is. And that's why then the conclusion, we don't get to hear about abolition. We hear about justice reinvestment as though somehow the state is still an innocent actor in all of this, that we can appeal to them.
Mm.
Why are we talking to the economist? Why aren't we talking to the abolitionist? And we had one there. We had Vicky Roach. We had Deb Kilroy. But we didn't hear about, we didn't get to have that conversation about what abolition might mean.
Or even the aspect of looking at, I think Mick Gooder brought it up, looking at John Pat. you know, his case and how that was one of the main cases that sort of spurred on the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody as well.
And you look at any of these cases, the corruption, the shonky investigations, they're horrific, and those families still haven't seen justice. Like it's and for people who haven't read the Royal Commission Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, haven't looked at the cases. But you don't even have to look to the past. You can look at the current cases now. The fact that Nathan Reynolds' death, and it was his anniversary just this week, that his death, having an asthma attack on the floor of a prison cell, was deemed natural causes. You know, like they're still covering themselves up. And the coronial inquiries, that's what they're doing. They're acting as an alibi for the state and absolving them of their violence. And it's happening every week there's a new coronial inquiry and people aren't paying attention. Like families are crying on the steps of coroner's courts all the time. And so continually bare our wounds, you've got to go, well, hang on, this isn't working. And we can't trust them to find themselves guilty of their own violence.
And I remember I had a chat to Alison Whittaker, you know, and she's doing some amazing studies within this sort of space as well. And she, you know, explained, you know, different aspects of sort of a journey that family may go through. And she spoke about sort of the coronial inquest. Well, that's not an investigation where they sort of point the fingers at the police officers to sort of determine the way that these mob died, you know. And after explaining that, then it's sort of, you know, and then the family has to go through, you know, a whole nother sort of traumatic sort of journey to sort of try and find some justice, you know, thinking that, you know, through any of the stage of what they're going through is that you know, they'll find some sort of justice in this process as well. And what
the coronial inquiries are really violent for families because they perform this kind of idea that it's some sort of neutral, objective investigation. I was commissioned to provide an expert report to the coronial inquiry into the death of Mr. Nathan Reynolds. And I was instructed to look at the research that speaks about health literacy and the need to improve the health literacy of Indigenous peoples. That wasn't the story that I told. And in fact, I worked with colleagues Dr. Davis Singh and Helena Kajlik, who's a PhD candidate of mine, who's has been looking at coronial inquiries of deaths of blackfellas in the health system between 2000 and 2018. And there's a clear story that these coronial inquiries tell. What was interesting is I refused to tell the story they wanted me to tell, which would blame him for his death, and instead spoke about revisited the Royal Commission's deaths in custody recommendations and showed examples of Indigenous health services, in the case in Canberra, where there are Indigenous health services inside and different models of care. That report was left out of the coronial inquiry. So they commissioned me to write it, and when I didn't tell the story they wanted to hear, they just omitted it altogether. This is how this place works, and that's the coroner's office.
That's crazy. That's.
But this is how they are. Like this is our post Black Lives Matter movement, right? This is what it looks like in the colony. They pick and choose the evidence that they want to tell, the story that they want to tell. And the story is always the same, that no matter what they did, blackfellas were destined to die anyway, because that's been one of the foundational ideologies in this place. So when we show the violence and the brutalisation, we're showing them how good they're doing. So it doesn't inspire them to change. And this is where, for me now, it's interested in the conversations we have with each other about strategy, what works, and what works in a way that in the course of the fight that we still protect the black bodies that are on the front line as much as possible. Because I just think about, you know, the families who have to just relive this all the time. You know, I've had to deal with... I've got a current case active with the Queensland Police Service who arrested me in the Valley and took me into custody and assaulted me in custody, who refused to release the watch house footage and have disposed of it. But I've got bits of footage, parts of the story. I've got mobile phone footage of them assaulting me on the street, but I can't release it because as a result of me pursuing a race discrimination complaint against the Queensland Police Service,
Their lawyer got the Human Rights Commission to enforce a non-publication order on me so I can't release the footage that I have of them assaulting me on a public street here in Brisbane. That's justice in this place.
Mm.
Like it's a well-oiled machine, and it doesn't matter if who you are as a black fella, what you've done, how compliant, non-compliant, functional, dysfunctional, doesn't matter. It's the same story. It's the same violence enacted every day. And I think that's why I feel betrayed by the solution in this documentary as it being about trauma and disadvantage.
Mm.
No, it's their violence.
Mm. You know, post this film, you know, where to... and you sort of mentioned, you know, and Kevin, brother Kevin, mentioned yesterday, saying, you know, who would have loved to see more of that sort of resilient side, the mob on the streets, you know, the family sort of asking about the United Nations case. I'm sorry, talking more about that in the film, you know, more hearing more from abolitionists, because we saw a bit of Deb and Vicky Roach as well, you know. With what we can, you know, and at the beginning of sort of our chat, you said, you know, the families have had, you know, said their stuff in this film. Now it's sort of up to us, and what is it that we can do?
There's lots of things we can do depending on what position we occupy.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I still think people need to watch the documentary for the concerns. I think it's given families have taken the time to tell their story, to return to this time and time again. It's incumbent upon us to hear them, to hear their story. I think people have to find what it is that they can do within their respective places they occupy, and then stretch themselves beyond what they imagine they can do. I'm always working out what can... And, you know, yourself, you always think about what can we do? It's a daily conversation we have with ourselves about how do we... What do we do here? What can we do there? And where there's always this sense that there's never enough. And we know that it's never enough because the violence is so unrelenting and so every day. I think it's important that people don't turn away. I think it's important that people don't look to these stories as the kind of, I think a colleague referred to as a misery memoir. You have to look at these stories, and then you have to think about what you can learn from black fellas who've shared those stories. We are not just subjects testifying to our trauma. All of the mob that have been interviewed, are still finding ways to get some form of justice in this place.
Literally, yeah.
I just think about all, you know, Dylan, April, the foundation, you know, like just everyone's, they're still doing the work. So why aren't we? And I think, and it's that there's no one approach. There are political approaches, there's the intellectual, there's the legal, there's the interpersonal. We have to be explicit in naming race and racial violence. This whole thing where, you know, we kind of find palatable ways to speak about racial violence, it's not doing anyone any good. Well, it's not doing us any good. So I think it's we have to be as courageous as the families that turned up to appear in this documentary and as consistent as what they are.
Definitely. Just for the listeners really quickly, if you are tuning in, my guest on Let's Talk is Chelsea Watego, and we're, you know, having this yarn about the Incarceration Nation film, very heavy film. As I mentioned earlier, I watched it half it one night and then the other half the next night. As you mentioned, you know, when we're confronted with our trauma, it's sort of less inspiring because we know the sort of the daily things that we go through, that we witness, and how we process that as well. And you mentioned this earlier as well, it was like they were putting lots of pieces, you know, to the film as well, which sort of left out maybe any hope of sort of having that sort of resilient side into the film as well, to, you know, in a 1 hour, hour and a half film as well.
there's that scene where there's like a montage of black fellas being brutalised to the backdrop of a song, which is a really powerful song and an important song. But that was one of the concerns I did raise in the pre-screening was what was the function of that? What is it doing? Who is it doing it to? Because, you know, we're going to talk about the fact that trauma is the underlying cause for incarceration, and then we produce something that causes trauma to black people. We've got to kind of think about that a little bit more, you know? And I say to someone who has grapples with it, I'm as someone who's called a race scholar, I think about what is my ethics in of an anti-racist practice, that you can't just take people's stories and use them as examples of your theorising about the world. In the process of telling them, they have to restore a sense of power and humanity in the process of it. It can't be extractive because that's very colonising, to take someone's story and then just and lay it out like that. So But Mariki Onus, she tweeted this week about, we're having this conversation about trauma, and she tweeted, some of the discourse around transgenerational trauma implies that A, colonialism is historical, and B, our parents and grandparents are now the problem.
Mm.
You know, and so I know as a black fella that we all have stories of intergenerational trauma, and we all work on our healing in all kinds of ways, and all, in, you know, it's an ongoing process that we're all engaged in. But when it comes to incarceration and state-sanctioned violence, the gaze needs to be at the state, the laws, its policies, and it cannot continue this lie that the state is some innocent actor in this whole arrangement. It has always been violent to us.
I'd love to have a chat about sort of, you know, blackfellas and, you know, I guess, you know, we, you know, any side the blackfellas is on, you know, we're always seen as being black as well. You know, in the film, it shows, you know, one black officer, you know, your former partner, you know, being a black officer here in Brisbane. And then the other night when I watched after the apology, one of the aunties, she was, you know, worked for the department, you know, and she sort of recounted her story of, you know, removing a child, and then, you know, not so long after that, you know, they remove her child. Yep. Her granny's from her. I'd love to talk about that side of sort of the colony and how that impacts our mob, because, you know, we always come up against this as well, and, you know, how active and staunch our mob are, you know what I mean? Like, we're really quick to, you know, sort of put it against our own mob that are on sort of the other side.
Yep.
As well, you know. And you know, doing the podcast as well, you know, one of the episodes that I did was on the Queensland Native Mounted Police and, you know, how brutal, you know, they were in the frontier. I'd love to sort of, talk about how, you know, in the colony, you know, we're still seen as who we are, as subhuman, even when we're doing sort of the, if we want to call it, the dirty work.
You know, agents have been enacted as agents of the state. Like, there's no escaping that. I think it's, look, I think every position that blackfellas occupy in the colony in terms of the work that we do it can be read as contradictory. And whether you're a teacher or a police officer, whether you work in the academy or the police service, you can still do. But your social worker are just as violent as a police officer. So I think there's often there's a mistake. We think that if you work in, if you work as a police officer, if you work in this particular place, then you're on that side, as though the teacher who's teaching a violent curriculum isn't exercising colonial violence, as though the social worker who works for the department or even works for the agency that then aids the department in their work. Every Indigenous liaison position is potentially an agent of the state when you think about the function of those roles in helping the state visit their programs upon Indigenous peoples. So I think we need to think about that. One's just more explicit. I used to feel sorry for my partner being a police officer, and I thought I was safe working at a university. And I come to realise, oh, no, they're both violent places. One just has a very sophisticated way of exercising that. They've intellectualised their violence, right? And you can't see the bruises in the same kind of way. So I had to think about how I resist that. When Matthew came to the police, that was because I'd been locked up in Dalby. That was the first time I'd been locked up on a street charge. And me and it turned out another fellow who'd come out from Inala, we were locked up same time. You know, we're looking at him going...
When you take him out of Inala, that's what happens. No.
I'm getting my mugshot taken and brother's in the cell. And, you know, and we just went for a night out. You know, the ease in which black fellas find ourselves incarcerated, like that's... It's so regular. It's so routine, right?
First time outside a protest and that I got locked up was... yeah.
That disclaimer.
Yeah, yeah. Was on the night of Invasion Day. And I was breaking up a fight.
Well, you know when I got locked up here in the Valley, that was the night of Wild Black Woman TV show.
Oh, true.
The filming of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't celebrate too much.
No, no, that's it.
Can't get too angry,
it.
Can't get too happy. That'll put you away. But so... He became a police officer because of the experience of violence. And a lot of us have this idea that, you know, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And so black fellas can go into these places with, I hate to say the best of intentions, but wanting to change the system. And we have this thing where we're caught between being dehumanized but at the same time trying to be superhuman in these places to effect change when it's structural. It's not about the one officer, though there are occasions where having the one officer in the right place at the right time can make a hell of a lot of difference. And I know over the course of Matthew's 15 years as an officer, there are a lot of times where it was so good that he was there, you know, and there at times, because when he came back from Dalby, we lived in Inala and he worked in his own community. It wasn't in some other place. Like Native Police, they went to other places. This was now I'm working my own community because I want different from my community. Not everyone goes to these systems with those intent though either. And this is where I think I arrived at the position of F hope is because a lot of us have hope that if we just did this, we just did that, if we, you know, we have hope in these institutions that there is a possibility for them to change. And after, you know, 15 years retiring on medical grounds, there was a realisation that it didn't matter how much he withstood the racial violence of his workmates. He's never going to change. They didn't want to stop his son getting street checked. Didn't stop him getting street checked even as a copper. You know, so you just can't change it. And that's not to say it's hopeless, but our strategy cannot be bound up in having hope in their institutions to change. And the idea that if there was just more of us there, that we could fix it.
Well, yeah, there's a saying, you know, I think that applies to all Indigenous peoples around the world, is, you know, existing in two worlds or walking in two worlds, you know. And, you know, the whole F hope thing, you know, is very, very understandable, you know. But, you know, I don't know, is there a point of change? You know what I mean? Like, oh, yeah, there's a whole thing of, you know, we make our own change and all this, you know.
So retiring hope is not coming to the position that it's all hopeless. Retiring hope is changing our strategy. Not to being dependent upon the perpetrator. And not waiting for them.
Like we can do that on a, I guess in a way we can do it on a smaller level, like individual level, you know, maybe a family and possibly a community level, you know. But any higher than, you know, at any level of those things, you know what I mean? Like it's still going to be the same.
I think about your own activism. It's not predicated upon idea of getting it, of acceptance.
And I think that's why I wanted to do the podcast was to sort of change up what I do and to sort of look for another avenue to sort of lean on as well, you know. Wholly and solely, you know, activism is my thing because it's introduced me to so many different other things.
Yep.
To radio, to podcasting, to amazing people, you know, especially black fellows from different parts of this country.
Mm-mm.
As well. You know, and Evan's my partner as well.
Absolutely.
You know. And that's always gonna wholly and solely be me as well, you know, but there is those sort of avenues of change.
Yeah, and so, because the thing is retiring hope in colonial institutions means then returning to black power. When we say sovereignty never ceded, what does that mean in an everyday embodied sense? What is that to be that all the time and not be dependent upon them to grant that to us? So for me, retiring hope is not hopelessness, it's a return to our own power. And when we know our power, we can strategize in all kinds of interesting ways. And that's what our old people did.
Yeah.
Like, I just think, I remember reading in Fiona Foley's book, Biting the Clouds, and she tells a story of this old fella over on the island there, and he kept coming over to the mainland, and the police were trying to stop him, and they end up chaining his boat to a tree. He cut down the tree, you know? And I think in this era, post-2000, we've had over two decades of an extremely racist policy framework of closing the gap of this, you know, statistical aspiration to whiteness. Mm-hmm. We have to return to what it is to be powerful in our own right, on our own terms, not as measured against them, on their terms. And we have a generation now that can't even remember the idea of self-determination, who didn't grow up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Even as limited as it was, don't know that the possibility of black people being in charge of our own business. Mm-hmm. And that's scary to me. So for me, it's like, I'm not appealing to white fellas. Our conversation needs to be with each other about what we do, because they can't change that. Mm-hmm. And so it's to retire hope is to return to our power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is that's amazing and mad, you know, like to think of and to sort of bring it back to that as well. And it's right too, you know, that generation who sort of forgotten about sort of, you know, what it was, you know, to have sort of, you know, to see, you know, black ownership, you know, to see the doors open, you know, to buildings like this, to...
Who have been indoctrinated by all these youth aspiration role modelling programs that are run by white fellas. Like, there's a bustling industry. We talk about the kids in care, but there is a bustling industry around Indigenous education in our high schools of doing these role model aspiration building programs with our kids, not run by our communities. And they're doing leadership stuff and indoctrinating these kids into being a particular kind of Aborigine. Like, we've got to take that back. And there's so many of them. There's, you know, you get a cool T-shirt and a hoodie, but what are we trading in return?
Yes.
And so there are all kinds of ways in which colonial violence is being enacted upon us, and it's not just in custody.
Mm-hmm.
We can see the most brutal versions of it, but it's happening in classrooms too.
Mm-hmm. I remember when I was at... when I was down to Pilliga, it sort of been like 6 years, four, just before Nalini was born. And, yeah, we had a protest, you know, these gates were sort of, you know, knocked open. We ran on this equipment, held it, you know, there was farmers there. We got back to the camp and, you know, like the white fellow was like, oh, you know, can, you know, the most whack thing that I've experienced at post the rally was this white fellow saying, yeah, can you tell us 30, you know, just quickly 30 seconds of something good that happened today, you know, and people saying, oh, the farms and the black fellows together and all these things. And, you know, when I was in my town, I was like, oh, sorry, guys, I'm not going to, you know, say anything good for 30 seconds. You know, and I sort of spoke about how, you know, there's many different fields that black fellows walk in or lanes that we walk in where we experience sort of, you know, violence.
Mm-mm.
You know, whether it's driving home, getting picked up, you know, kids being on a list to be, you know, taken to sort of, you know, all these different things. And, you know, like it's you know, because people have this notion of, you know, colonialism was the frontier, you know, this whole brutalization of us. And just now when you're sort of speaking, like, as if sort of police brutality is the only sort of brutality that we face today as well, you know, structural racism, you know, as we see it today.
I've got five kids and I can tell you the everyday violence of the education curriculum, the number of fights I've had to have with schools about what they're insisting that my child do in order to pass a subject, which requires them to deny their own humanity and deny their sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from things like, let's debate the Mabo decision. Sorry, it was a decision of the High Court. We've got to accept it, not debate it.
Mm-hmm.
And so their ability as a learner is their ability to tell a story about them maybe not being deserving of the rights that we know we're entitled to. There was the one of the they had to do a role play where they had to pretend to be a pastoralist, and the others had to pretend to be Aborigines. And the story that they were told was the pastoralist didn't want any trouble, but it was the troublemaking Aborigines, you know, stealing
our version of Cowboys and Indians.
Yeah, and this is in what, grade 10 at a high school in 2021. Our kids have been required to perform this. That is violent.
Yes.
And there's just so many examples. I mean, you know, I've got a kid who every week walks out of assembly when they sing that anthem, but who got bullied by a teacher about that decision. You know, like, they're brutalising our kids in all kinds of ways, even the ones that are in our care. Because when we have to hand them over into those classrooms every day, we've got to subject them to that violence. And this is the thing that makes me wild when they talk about school absenteeism. Well, why do you think that is?
I just saw actually somebody tweet on Twitter in regards to a school down in Bogabilla, you know, and the school was saying, maybe I shouldn't have said the community, but I just did, and the school was saying, oh, you know, if your student hasn't logged into sort of their learning sort of app, you know, like we'll put a police report out. I think it was like from Bunjalung. Buddy, brother, man, on Instagram, yeah, put that out.
Well, when my child decided to refused to stand for the anthem. Refused to stand for the anthem, and then got bullied by a teacher throughout the day, and so they walked off the school grounds and walked home. Right, a police car turned up to find, and they were inside hysterical, thinking that they were going to get taken.
I saw Larissa. We'll wrap up soon as well. So I saw Larissa Baldwin's tweet the other day about, you know, the brother who passed away, you know, from COVID, and, you know, one of the major papers decides, like, you know, indicate that, you know, this lad had, you know, a criminal record or whatever.
And who was a respected person in the community? Because we saw all the you know, mob sending condolences and expressing their loss, and it shows not even in death are we afforded any dignity. Not even in death. And to, you know, like, this was in The Australian. I mean, I'm not saying that in a surprised way, but, you know, this is a national broadsheet. And they get to do this. And what's the consequence? Nothing. And that family have to go through that suffering, as if they're not suffering enough. Like, this is where we can't appeal to them to see our humanity, because they're the ones that are so inhumane.
And, you know, these last couple of weeks, you know, just sort of, you know, shows their disregard for our mob, you know, under sort of a global pandemic and a huge shutdown in New South Wales.
Well, this is what made me wild. There were all these messages going out to mob about mob, you know, if you care for your mob, then you'll do this and do that, and lecturing mob. No, you should be appealing to the state to get the vaccinations out, to make sure that mob got food supply. Because our communities are trying to organise to make sure people got food. But yet, so that's what, there was this really paternalistic, condescending kind of, is that, you know, the spread of COVID is solely because the natives aren't compliant and don't care about their own communities. We saw when COVID first hit, communities across the country were shutting down without direction from the state. And those that could exercise their sovereignty did, and locked down their communities and protected them. So this idea that somehow we don't care enough about ourselves, I mean, we're the ones that are most committed to our survival. So we should be the ones in charge of all of this. But yet we're not.
On that note, sis, thank you for joining us on Let's Talk. It's always a pleasure to have you on air here as well. And if you are just tuning in, Chelsea Watergo has joined us for this conversation about Incarceration Nation, the film, but more broadly as well, I think, you know, like, this last part, you know what I mean? Like, we sort of took it beyond sort of, you know, having out about the film, which I think is important as well. And I think we need to continue to sort of look at how, you know, Australia impacts and, you know, continues to sort of brutalise, you know, our mob on a daily. But thanks, sis, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And if you enjoyed the program, just remember you can go to our website at 989fm.com.au for the links to the podcast, which will be up a little bit in the day. As always, you've been listening to Let's Talk here on 989FM, Murray Country.